everybody. Welcome back to The Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm Willie.
Hi there, this is Jakob, and this is a podcast where the co-hosts do a deep read into each and every episode of The Wire.
That's right. And just, you know, saying this right off the top here, we haven't recorded in a couple of weeks. Our schedules haven't aligned. And unfortunately, we do have to bring up the news about the unfortunate, tragic passing of Michael K. Williams. We're sure that we, you know, express the same sentiments as everybody out there who loves The Wire and who's listening to us, that this is just such a tremendous loss. Extremely sad for his community that he did so much charitable work for, and for film and acting community at large. His performance really changed the way we see things on film and TV. So it's a really sad time for all of us.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing all that, Willie. And, you know, I know he meant a lot to us here as huge fans of The Wire. That's obviously why we are participating in this project here, Willie. And, you know, I mean, I don't really know what else I could say or add to the conversation that's already being had about his legacy and, you know, how he helped shape the greatest show ever. And just also, like you said, the work he does or did outside of, you know, the show. And I just want to read a quick tweet here from D. Watkins.
Please
shout
do.
Out. So, Michael K. Williams showed love in the realest way and birthed so many careers in Baltimore. People act like The Wire was just a show. It was so much more. The Wire was an outlet, a beginning, and a way out, and then a way back in to help so many people. So I think that really kind of just speaks to what the show meant to everyone who, you know, was lucky enough to take part in it, and then also the impact that it had on Baltimore, and then, you know, just how Michael K. Williams, he's so much bigger than Omar, and, you know, just great guy, huge loss.
Yeah. Beautiful words there from D. Watkins. In the light of all this news, we decided to route all the donations that we've received so far in doing this project and donating it to Michael K. Williams's nonprofit organization that he had started called Making Kids Win. It's all about helping kids avoid gun violence and end mass incarceration. Some really noble causes there. So, you know, just as we say every week, if you donate to us at anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support, that money will now be going to Michael K. Williams's nonprofit, Making Kids Win. You could also donate directly on his website. That's at makingkidswin.com/donate.html. And we'll probably, you know, there's like some videos he did explaining the mission of the nonprofit that we'll probably share on the social media pages as well. Just a really beautiful mission that he is trying to do there. And it's kind of indicative of The Wire's influence on a lot of the creative people that took part in the show. Sonia Son also started a nonprofit called Rewired for Change. And I think it just shaped a lot of people's views who had the chance to work on it and made them more community and charity oriented. So anything else you want to add?
Oh, yeah. I mean, thanks for sharing all that. So we hope to see your support for these great causes. And just, you know, if you're wondering more about his organization, his nonprofit, there was a pretty good Vice segment or a project where he talked about, I think it was Raised in the System. You know, just I think it ties in into a lot of what, you know, his mission was with his nonprofit, that episode. So
we'll be sure
just
to post
keeping kids free and Yeah, like you said, avoiding mass incarceration and helping underserved communities on the East Coast, Baltimore, Newark, and so forth. So
we'll be sure to post links and videos and all that good stuff for that. So moving on, we also have some other news. In case you haven't been following us on Twitter, we did a crossover episode. Was that a week ago or two weeks ago we did a crossover episode with another fabulous Wire podcast called Rewired, with two sisters, Kelly and Bailey Reed. And we talked all about the similarities between The Wire and Generation Kill. Is a great conversation, so be sure to check them out at Rewired Podcast, and we hope to work with them again in the future.
Yeah, it was a great time talking with Kelly about those topics related to Generation Kill and The Wire, and it's great to meet and talk to all sorts of Wire super fans and just exploring all the different ways that this show has impacted other television, or the creations of, David Simon, Ed Burns, and everyone involved with The Wire. So yeah, definitely check them out. Great stuff they got going on there. So we're thankful to have participated, and my apologies for that random burp. I'll take blame for it, Willie. I've been recently trying to be more health conscious and get in shape for various reasons. So I was indulging in some Synergy kombucha, and I don't know. I honestly don't remember it happening, but yeah. I guess we were so lost in the great conversation we were having.
I think we were in a fugue state. We were intoxicated from all the, hot takes we were exchanging with each other.
It was like some sober Balmer's Peak thing going on there.
There you go. This opening scene of season 4, episode 9, Know Your Place, is a stunner.
Yeah, they got some SpongeBob jokes going on the corner, on Bodie's corner.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge SpongeBob fan. I don't have anything against it, but, I think if you tuned into if you listen in to Generation Kill, the Generation Kill crossover episode, you'll learn more about me and the context as to why I might not know much about SpongeBob.
I mean, I feel like we've discussed it on our podcast before.
Okay, but never mind. Scrap that.
I mean, not to mention SpongeBob is also a show for children.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but I mean, I was like, preteen, teen when it was coming out.
No, fuck that, man. As soon as you get to middle school, you're raised on prestige television. No.
Yeah, everyone is Willy. Like, no, I don't think I'm going to that birthday party. Would you like to come over and watch Carnival with me? I'm like, what is this Dust Bowl Carney show? What the hell? It's like Grapes of Wrath meets a carnival. And like, I don't even understand what's going on.
Yeah, that was like the first HBO show I watched.
You lived it, man. You had the hats. You were just like, I'm like, wait, well, that's you, Willie. That's you walking home from high school dressed as if you're on your way to some tent in the middle of Missouri.
So anyway, Poot comes back. He's released from jail, and he gets like, Bodhi's happy to see him. It's a little bit of a nice reunion, but it's also kind of shocking how like unceremonious his return back into normal society is, as if it's just like a normal thing. He may or may not have already contracted a venereal disease at this point.
Yeah. Poot's just, he's a soldier.
He's a soldier, like, and, kind of fitting into like the whole allegory about cyclical power structures. Like, Bodhi lets him in on the news that they're working for Marlowe now. And he's like, hey, man, whatever. Different boss, same me.
One boss, same as the other. I like that take, though. And then Eric shows up and you know, Herc and the cops are looking for little Kevin.
Yeah, they're very thick-headed, and they don't realize, like, the penchant for using those nicknames ironically. Pretty brilliant direction in this episode. I know I've, like, tried to, like, stray away from, like, talking about, like, oh, the filmmaking aspects of this, but it is pretty brilliant how they, like, economically cut down on, like, the exposition needed or, like, some useless dialogue. You know, I can imagine a sizable chunk of the audience have already forgotten who little Kevin is. So, like, when Herc makes the announcement and they do the little, like, rack focus on little Kevin's face, you know, giving a pretty big clue as to who it is, it's a great way of, like, economizing the information. But Herc and Dozerman are following, like, the line of thinking, like, oh yeah, anybody under 5'6" and 125 pounds, get in the vehicle. Not really doing any real police work. Herc is just, he's seeing red, he has a vendetta, and he's making some pretty horrible decisions that are going to have ripple effects on the people around him that he interacts with, what we'll talk about a little bit later.
Yeah. Yeah, this is it. I recently saw the Dominic Lombardozzi response to
what's the worst thing Herc did.
This is it. Like, this is pretty much the episode where he does both things.
Yeah. Pretty bad.
Sounds like a bad thing he's doing then.
Yeah, but it's nice that Dominic Lombardozzi, you know, in real life seems like a really, like, nice, chill, upstanding guy, and, like, does everything he can to, like, distance himself from this horrible character that he's playing.
Yeah, and if you want to see his range as a cop character, check out The Deuce.
Yeah,
he's it's a bit different.
Yeah. So let's talk about Omar in this situation.
RIP. It's this is not something I thought would, you know, happen during our recording.
Right.
Obviously. I mean, during the time span that we're working on this, where you look back on, like, oh wow, this is my first time watching the show, you know, and so and so has passed away. So it's kind of a trip that I'm sure every, you know, Wire fan is going through right now.
But his character, the help that Bunk did for him worked out, and he gets released from Bel Air detention in Harford County.
Yeah, italicized, Willie, so I can call back on this for the geo.
There you go.
You notice my the patterns, right? Anything in the italicized, that's for the map later.
But Bunk meets him at his release, and he offers him kind of an ultimatum. You know, he knows that they both have done this little tit-for-tat thing, giving favors for each other when they needed it. But Bunk is just saying, like, look, now that you're out, just don't kill anybody else, please. You're making my job hell.
Yeah.
So no more bodies.
What do you think about that ultimatum or a deal that Bunk is pushing? I mean, obviously that's like every law enforcement officer's job, right?
Right.
Like, don't murder. And I mean, as citizens, we don't actively like endorse homicides, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, it's just, unfortunately for Bunk, Baltimore is just way more, like, it's too nuanced and, you know, things happen. So,
I mean,
what I'm saying is, after Butchie's killed brutally, I advocate for murder. You can't just kill Butchie and expect nothing to happen.
I know.
But he doesn't know who Butchie is, Bunk, that is.
Exactly. And it's also like, I mean, Omar is just like in such a different train of thought that, like, when he first gets out, he's like, oh, I can help you by, what is he? He's like, I can go to Andre and, like, find out something for you. And that's what prompts Bunk to give him the ultimatum, or he.
Yeah.
So Omar is just like in a totally different mind frame of, like, what he could do to be helping Bunk in this situation. And Bunk is just like, no, maybe you don't, like, go out with the intention of killing people, but the things you do on a day-to-day basis are getting people killed around you. So just please for me, stop doing that. Vernon Holly, or no, Crutchfield is really mad at me right now.
Yeah. And then, you know, Bunk wants to literally take him to a train station to Aberdeen.
Yeah.
Locally, I guess, to get out of town. And he says, man, he says, a man got to live what he know.
Yeah.
So that speaks to the overall theme of the episode, right?
Yeah. Know your place. Andre, well, we'll get into Old Face Andre's thing later and how there's a similar type of situation going on there.
But he has left town before. I mean, McNulty literally was able to help him get out of town to be the Bronx's problem or New York City. So,
but yeah, so Omar at one point doesn't seem like he's going to more or less stay true to his word, and him and his new lover,
Naldo,
are surveilling Andre's corner store, knowing, you know, of course, that it was a stash house, blah, blah, blah. Sees that, you know, Andre's not around, so they kind of put two and two together and realize that Marlo is behind all this. And which leads to that really, like, beautiful scene at the end there that will go more into detail, where he's kind of, like, looking out for Michael as he kind of sells his soul to Marlo because of, like, domestic problems he's having. Kind of, like, maybe foreshadowing later on that Michael's going to, like, take over Michael's going to take over Omar's position in the drug war as being, like, the Robin Hood type, you know? Everything is cyclical. It's all circular. Time is a flat donut. Shout out to Nathan Corbett. Thank you for liking our tweet about that. Yeah. I'm sure you're obsessing over it just as much as we are, bragging about it to all of your friends.
Yeah. I have that screenshot. And if anyone asks in the future, you know, what was the singular crowning moment of this, you know, endeavor, and worth all of the, you know, hours of editing and failing at, you know, production stuff. So it's like, hey, Nathan Corbett liked our tweet.
There you go.
About donut.
Yeah.
And, you know, True Detective pun or whatever.
Yeah. Also, like, another thing that kind of, like, reinforces the interconnectedness of all of these disparate characters is as soon as Omar leaves the corner store, it hops, you know, he drives right by Michael talking to Dookie and Randy about what to do about social services. So it's, you know, foreshadowing on multiple levels how everybody's kind of connected in that way.
Do you just want to talk about the boys' lives and Tillman stuff from there?
Yeah. I mean, it's as good a time as any.
Shout out to the director, Alex Zakarzewski, as Willie just had, you know, respectfully looked it up. Very economical with the shots of this episode and meshing it all together. That's like,
that's our shit.
Is he emulating our style of, you know, podcasting? Alex is right here actually directing our episode.
But another, like, beautiful example of, like, how things are so, like, flawlessly woven together. And just want to talk about this one scene where Presbo realizes his colleague is lamenting the fact that her car is stolen. And then the very next shot is a donut parking her car illegally, you know, on red curb, and going to meet Naaman and Bodhi for a seminar on drug dealing.
Yeah, it's like, I can't believe he's on Red Curb. I never heard Red Curb sounds like some startup, like parking meter company or something. Like, yeah. Download your Red Curb app if you want to save money on parking in Metro Atlanta.
No, that sounds like a snitching app. That sounds Red like you take pictures of someone who's illegally parked and then send it in. And then, you know, you get like a small profit off of the ticket that they have to pay.
Red Curb brought to you by Karen's United.
There you go.
Yeah, it's like, shame on Donut for parking illegally as he pulls up to deal heroin.
Or like a stolen car.
Yeah, just stole a car. It's like literally a teacher's parking permit. Like, what is that a permit for? If she has to street park, did she get her parking lot privileges revoked and kicked back out on the street where her car could get jacked? It's like, or just from, you know, to highlight the high turnover rate. And if we rewind it and isolate that image, it's actually an old, you know, parking pass for the last school she got, you know, laid off from or kicked out of for not producing better test score results, and her bumper just laden with these parking pass permits, just like liberal mom's bumper is like full of bumper stickers after taking her kids to downtown Berkeley to shop for thrift store items, and they just come back with a shit ton of like dumb whatever joke stickers.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if like you're you know, using any of your personal history and this and that. But anyway, for the infrastructure of the middle school, I don't recall there being like any like faculty parking lot or anything, because didn't Prez have to park on the street too when Donut, you know, Slim Jimmed his...
I mean, there's got to be, right? I mean, because I just assume he's a first-year teacher, so he doesn't get priority because it's like, you know, politics and the parking lot politics, you know.
Well, maybe she's a first-year teacher, too. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them, right, with the high, like, low retention rate and, like, the, you know, I mean, thanks to teachers like Grace, you know, coming back to the community, more experience. I don't know, though. There is a lot said about teachers' unions. And how, you know, that can retain, you know, underqualified teachers who really should, you know, hit the road. It's also, you know, kind of a hot button issue here in our state as we approach the recall election.
So Prez is finally making some headway in his class with keeping kids interested, talking about height and wingspan and like complimenting Michael on his reach as a boxer.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this with you.
Yeah.
If he tells Michael that, you know, your height and your wingspan are identical and should be, right?
Yeah.
Then why is he like, oh, I heard if you're good at boxing, you must have some kind of reach. Is he saying that because Michael's tall? Because he's obviously doesn't know about plus wingspans and how important those are in athletics. If he's like simping for identical height, you know, wingspan, because anyone knows, like, if you're into sports stuff, like, obviously Prez, you know, loses, like, he's not even like, you know, he's not trying to win.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't get how Michael must be a phenom. Like, he thinks Michael's just amazing athlete and boxer if he has an identical, like, that's a detriment to athletes.
Yeah, I mean, think that must have just been, you know, Prez's awkward attempt at you know, fraternizing with his students. But hey, you know, Michael smiled off of that, like, it you know, it kind of worked on him. It's way better than like anything Cuddy is trying to do to make an impact on his life.
Yeah, because Prez's comments about his wingspan are much less sus to Michael than Cuddy trying to like teach him footwork.
But Randy, the little schemer that he is, he's like found a new website that is like offering to sell candy in bulk.
A little schemer that he is. Jesus. I don't let you, I don't, because if I let this savage take slide on the podcast, then I just stand pat while you use them against me or my friends or loved ones. And I can't let that happen. I can't let that, you know.
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling me out and, you know, keeping me honest.
No, it's, I mean, it's funny. He is. I mean, he's,
yeah.
I'd say he's a hustler. I mean, you're a schemer, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, same, you know, one's maybe more like boomer talk, the other's more like modern.
There you go.
No, I'm just kidding.
He's buying candy in bulk so he could sell individual candies at a higher rate and make a profit off of it. And he ensnares Presbuluski, Mr. Presbuluski, in his little thing and giving him points on the package. So he's, you know, according to him, he's like using the lessons he's learned in Mr. Presbuluski's math class. But think, like, can we talk a little bit about the craps game since we're talking about Randy's math skills? He gets into that craps game.
That's great. Yeah, Randy brags about the game he picked up at Tillman Middle.
Yeah.
And
somehow that's what convinces Presbuluski to like get in on the candy.
He's like, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, he knows that he's contributing to something that could got Randy in trouble and on Donnelly's,
you know.
Yeah, like this kind of, I mean, it didn't necessarily lead exactly to the incident where he had to, you know, basically snitch and stuff.
Yeah.
But I mean, at this point, though, Randy's thinking beyond the sixth grade lunchroom, right? I mean, he's thinking about, like, hey, I mean, the Koreans can upsell and, like, you know, like, make a huge profit on this, so I can do it just like them.
Entrepreneurial brain he's got there.
Yeah, man. Post. But, I mean, to be fair, maybe it was safer. And I don't know, Randy's just screwed because that's how he met little Kevin in the first place too, right? With his stand. So it's like, I mean, it's either that or that's like kind of the point, right? Where if Randy's not selling candy, he's going to be selling like, you know, drugs. Not that that's the only thing he can do, of course, but that's like his options are very limited.
Yeah.
And as are everyone's.
It's the path he gets like beaten into taking. Basically, just from the system, like the system beats him down. So Prez is getting more disillusioned with the school system and how he's getting messages from the top down to strictly stick to the curriculum of the standardized state testing. And he's going to have to, you know, stray away from teaching math and only teach what's on the MSA. Is that Maryland State Assessment? Or
very good. As you can see, I had a question mark over that acronym, so you solved that one.
Yeah, and so he's a little disheartened by this whole thing, and he draws the parallel with his policing days and sees it no different than from when he had to juke the stats and make robberies become larcenies and rapes disappear and all that. So he's getting upset that wherever he goes, the system seems to prevail.
Yeah, Prez is really flexing his ex-cop knowledge in this episode. He's like, oh, Randy, I know about that. That's points on the package, you know? Yeah. And juking the stats. And people are like, oh, shit. Like,
yeah.
No wonder they got this guy. He knows what's up. He knows how the city works. And like, that's just going to screw you over.
Yeah. So we get some insight into like how hard Kennard really is when he gets busted by Carver and company. Calicchio is there too, right? They want to kind of like, he wants to take the hardcore approach, but Carver is straight up just like destroying evidence right in front of everybody and saying they're not worth it. But Kennard
Kennard's a
he's a beast. Dude. Yeah.
Put me down, motherfucker. Yeah.
You don't think I can jail? Like anybody who's watched this show a few times, you know, it's obviously a huge surprise when Omar's death does come at the hands of like this little kid. But if you like watch the show again, like knowing who he is, like there's plenty of clues throughout that like hint to his true nature of being a stone cold little boy killer.
Yeah. And I was reading back and truth be told, the book compiled by Rafael Alvarez, and it was about, you know, Michael K. Williams and all the background info on him. You know, check it out. If you can get your hands on that book, even if they only sell the seasons 1 through 3 edition these days. But he was saying that his death, you know, he found it rather fitting because in the time he spent immersing himself in Baltimore in ways that really like no other actors were able to do. Yeah. He said, he's like, I knew some kids who were stone cold killers. Yeah. So, and then Tuliso Dingwall or Tuliso, that the actor who plays Kennard. Crazy story about him and that whole, you know, scene where he has, you know, where he kills Omar. So, and we'll talk about that, you know, in season 5. But let's just say at this point, you know, his parents may or may not have been super excited in his role, but like of him, like, you know, just cussing all, like just being crazy. So, you know, great acting.
Yeah.
Because this is not obviously like some kid they found, you know, on the street corner, just like actual corner kid, but he's so believable.
Yeah, it's really it's
scary. Yeah. It's like, damn, dude. And he's trashing on Naaman about Delonda having to get involved in everything. Yeah. Like shaming him after after Bodhi has let him have it.
Yeah.
By the way, what is up with this geo that Bodhi's conveying to Naaman about their corners and stuff? Maybe I misheard it, but he's talking about you got Bentaloo or Benaloo. That's I think what he said, which is a north south street in west side Baltimore. He's like, you got that to Rosewood, if I heard him right, and that doesn't make sense. And then Bodhi's talking about, oh, I got Monroe to Payson, which is like, you know, they're pretty much a block apart running north-south on the west side. So that can make sense. And they said you got to have lookouts all up and down Franklin Town or on Franklin Town. So maybe I'm taking it too literally and thinking of the like Franklin Town, the road that runs through the far west side of Baltimore, but that's way out of the way. So I don't know, you know, maybe that's like a joke, like send Kennard over to Franklin Town to be a lookout. Yeah. Franklin Town? You know, that's all the way across the city. That's what he'd probably say.
Yeah.
But Naaman's scared to go to Cheltenham.
Yeah, that's right.
But he doesn't believe that Carver can send him there.
Yeah.
Anyways. Yeah,
Carver softened up a lot.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. I know I spend too much time taking the activities of the police too literally. So I'm like, man, forget that. I can't even. Me giving some praise to his arc of redemption is being a badge licker. No. Yeah. But I mean, you know, he's not completely terrible person, but what are you gonna do? I mean, it's like
he did do some bad things. I mean, the little moment he has with Daniels later on in this episode when Daniels gets promoted to colonel and they like shake hands and smile at it, like it's kind of like an awkward thing there because there's a lot of like bad blood and history between the two of them where like Carver feels ashamed for ratting him out basically, but is you know, he recognizes that he's talented and good and wants to congratulate him for it and put the bad stuff behind them.
Let's talk about the dinner challenge with Bunny and his, was it special corner kids? By the way, Willie didn't mean, I assume, you know, it's for like corner kids that are special. It's just, it's a special class for corner kids.
There you go. I didn't mean any offense. A pretty famous scene here where Bunny takes the kids who won the competition in the class to build a model Eiffel Tower. He takes them to Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, and they're totally at a loss for what to do in this environment. Like, the maitre d' is a different person than the waitress, and there even is like a waitress who's like listing off all these fancy foods that are included in the special. And I have a feeling this is probably a lot due to the influence of the writer of this episode,
Kia Corthron,
who was I think David Simon was inspired to have her join the writing staff because he had read a play that she had written. She's like a pretty active East Coast playwright who added a lot of depth to these kids' characters and interactions and dialogue. She admitted that she had a problem writing some of the political stuff. But yeah, this is, I think, the one and only appearance she makes on the writing staff. And she's probably responsible for like one of the most famous scenes in the show.
Yeah.
And
I mean, we had talked about it, you know, that this is probably the only black female writer on the show.
Yes.
If we're, I mean,
maybe. We have to look into that.
There are few enough to...
And where it's noticeable, yeah.
Yeah. So, great stuff. I mean, we'll post a link to an article from The Sun about, you know, the Wire Watch series where they highlight her. And as Willie stated, you know, the background of, you know, her playwriting skills and her work. I think it was about girl gangs in the Bronx called Breathe Boom. So
that's right. Yeah.
We got to check that out, Willie.
Pretty amazing level of detail, the way like the kids act surrounding this incident. So like,
yeah,
when they're pulling up to the restaurant, Naaman just like trying to curry favor with Bunny, like, oh, like, I like your Billie Holiday music. This is great. Once they get into the restaurant, they feel like, it's like the level of like defeat and like depression that is on their faces is pretty stunning.
Yeah. I know there's obvious parallels with kind of like the early season one dinner
with D'Angelo and his girlfriend, Donette.
Donette. Yeah. I was like, Donette. And great performances here by, Taylor King and Devon Cooper.
Yeah.
I hope I nailed that. Zenobia and Darnell, respectively.
Yeah.
So, Zenobia, like, is this just kind of like the, it's not a stare. I mean, you know, girls are more mature than boys at this age. Yeah. She seems to know a lot more of how things are going to occur. And Darnell...
puts a napkin around his neck like a bib. But I was going to say, like, the progression of, like, their behavior is pretty fascinating. How, like, Naaman wants to curry favor with Bunny. They get humiliated inside the restaurant. They go back to being, like, pretty, like, coarse and rambunctious and profane, almost like as a backlash to that experience as they're leaving. And then the next day, they're, like, bragging to everybody about, like, how much fun they had at Ruth's Chris. Like, there's so many, like, layers of insecurity and, just, like, general discontentment with the system that is, again, like, just with that progression, it's pretty economical how it's laid out, but it speaks volumes. I mean, I guess Bunny does get into, like, kind of, like, the theorizing about like what it like trying to deconstruct like what they're actually feeling when he's talking to Parenti. So it does like get a little, it's not exposition heavy. It's just like it, pinpoints or like, you know,
I mean
that dinner table scene has all the dinks.
Yeah. There you go. Dink. Well, I mean, Bunny, I think he's pretty concise in summing up, you know, like this is all tying into Know Your Place, right? And the kids, they don't really feel like they have a place or seat at the table. So he's like, how do you get them to believe in themselves when they can't even admit their feelings about who they are and what they're doing in the world? So pretty tough place to be. So I don't know. Bunny is he's doing his thing, you know. Yeah. Great actor, Bob Wisdom.
Yeah.
So he's like, you know, trying, like I think he said, he doesn't want to be perceived, or he doesn't want to approach the character as like a do-gooder, you know. But right. he also shows a lot of, you know, compassion and realizes like, man, this is messed up.
He's a great gift giver to Robert Wisdom. I received a cameo video from him for my birthday. So, you know, Randy has got it going pretty bad. His future got sold out by little Kevin. Dookie doesn't know that he's going to be a heroin addict yet. Naaman is having kind of an identity crisis. And Michael, of course, is still living with his abuser, his stepdad, and he's getting really protective of his little brother, Bug. And he is feeling like he might have to resort to some pretty drastic measures, much needed violence.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's gonna go beyond much needed.
It's even excessive, I'd say.
Oh yeah,
we'll talk about that more in the next episode when it actually occurs.
I just want to say, in the past, I've been, you know, in my little know-it-all rant, like, oh yeah, and in the corner, you know, DeAndre's friend RC even had a little brother named Bug. But it actually was his older brother named Bug. So obviously the Wire universe throwing curveballs, keeping us on our toes. But yeah, this is a tough scene because, as like you said, protective as Mike is of Bug, he, you know, is pretty much highlighting the limits of, you know, Mike, you know, regardless of him essentially being a parent as a middle schooler.
Yeah.
He's still unable to do, you know, basic things that, you know, are only privy to be handled by adults, like help Bug sign for his glasses.
Yeah.
He can't really be a true guardian.
Adult. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's tough place for Mike. So, I mean.
And it's like pretty crazy, like the levels of like patheticness that like happen in this like interaction between him and his stepfather, because like he's like, give me the DSS card, and you know Michael has to give him like the rude wake up call, like, you guys have already spent all the funds on it for this month. And then like his stepfather is like, well, you know, make sure I have it like by the first of the month next month then, like,
yeah.
Make sure I have it then. Like, pretty, you know, it's unfortunate that Michael has to deal with, you know, as big of a bitch as this guy is.
Forget everyone that we've talked about in the running for worst parents on the show, you know,
this guy is pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, Brianna and Delanda, you know, got their own things, but Mike's stepdad, probably worst parent.
So Michael is like trying to come up with a solution to his problem. He's kind of discussing it with his buddies and Randy, who has been, you know, kind of chewed up by the group home deal, lets him know that, you know, that's not a path that he wants to take. Michael lets his feelings be known about Cuddy and that he still feels kind of like weird around him and doesn't trust him. So he makes the very difficult decision to go to Chris and Snoop with his problems. And again, like, not a lot of dialogue in this last scene where he like goes into the courtyard, but we like know, you know, the context of everything about what's going on. Michael and Marlo shared that like look earlier on in the season where they both like realized how, you know, rough around the edges they really both were. It's almost kind of like when Michael is walking with Dookie to the courtyard and like he says like goodbye to Dookie. It's almost like this is like a goodbye, like for real in a lot of ways. Like I'm not going to be the same person after I do this. I'm not going to be the same Michael after this. Like it's really a touching exchange there, almost wordless, but communicates the message of growing up in a really fractured society pretty clearly. But yeah, so Marlo and Michael are having this little sit down. Omar, you know, remarks rather melancholy or remorsefully, like, oh, this is just a kid that's getting tangled up in all this bullshit with my arch enemy. I'm gonna write about it in my journal in the dark, which I like kind of forgot. Like he does keep a journal, or like he takes note of what people are doing, which is like, you know, the opposite of what Stringer told Shamrock to do in that meeting. You know, different, there's no one way to skin a cat in this drug game. You know, there's different avenues for success depending on how paranoid you are.
I mean, maybe, yeah, that's also why Ed Burns would say that the stick-up artists made the best informants after if they flipped, because, you know, I mean, obviously this is not Omar's motivation, but, you know, he knows everything pretty much about what's going on. Yeah. So.
We want to move on to talking about Prop Marjo or Prop Joe Marlo, Prop Jolo.
Okay, Jolo. Yeah, there you go.
No.
I mean, it was just written Prop Joe Marlo, and then you're like, Prop Marlarjo? Like, okay.
Okay.
Prop Jolo.
Let's move on to Prop Joe Marlo.
Joe Marlo. Joe Marlo, because you can't say Joe Mar, because then that's like Omar and Joe. Yeah, I mean, Prop Joe's,
they're like finally, him and Marlo are like finally in lockstep with each other on like what they want out of things, right? I mean, Marlo was let down by the little interaction they had that like he couldn't get a discount on like the New York package or whatever, but Prop Joe was like, you know, we're part of the co-op now. This is a society where we all look out for each other. And I have Andre for you. So you have something I want. I have something you want. It's all good. We all look out for each other.
Yeah. Andre definitely screwed Scott. Yeah. I mean, probably would have been better if Omar would have found him first or got a hold of him or not. I mean, because that could just be like a beating or like a shotgun shell to the leg. But
I mean, one thing I will say about Marlo, you know, everybody talks about how more evil he is than like, you know, the people that came before him. But at least like for the most part, you know, say for Mike's stepdad that we'll see in the next episode, they commit all their killings like pretty quickly. Like even when Slim Charles escorts Andre to his grave. Yeah. Chris is like, we're going to keep it quick, man. Like, don't worry about it. Like, you won't even see anything.
Yeah. So,
pretty economical killings that they do there.
Yeah. Yeah, the director, Alex, has been watching a super cut of Chris and Snoop.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Chris is pretty scary, like, when he... threatens Andre's girlfriend or whoever she was to him. I feel bad. Like, I feel like she really was like traumatized.
Oh yeah, for sure. Just,
I mean, great performance, but that must be scary. Like, I was thinking, how do you even set up a scene like that? Like,
but this is pretty like terrifying. Little exchange that Chris and Snoop have with Andre's girlfriend in exacting terror on everybody around Old Face Andre. Old Face Andre, you know, making, I guess, sort of a valiant effort to hide out with Prop Joe, but he's basically walking around in this episode, like, kind of read it on his face that he knows he's dead already, almost. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean,
he's like, I don't even know anything outside of B-more.
Yeah.
Where am I going to run to?
He's like in the most New York accent. No, no, he's a great actor. Who, I don't even shout out. It's sad. I mean, his network is so, so small. He just is like, sure, $2,000 for that place. Yeah. Anyways, yeah.
Alfonso Christian Lover. The scene where he knows that, you know, he's getting killed, like his biggest regret or like his bone to pick with them, like while he's on death's door, is like, you know, put me where, you know, I need to be somewhere where people can like find me. Like, I want people to know that I'm dead. Like, I'm sad that like I'm just gonna be like a blip. Like, I'm gonna be nothing to people.
Yeah,
I'm just gonna disappear.
Really dark stuff. That he's negotiating, yeah, and having to do that. It's like, you would hope that, like, at least the city could have some recourse in notifying your family and stuff, but that's not going to happen for a long time. I don't know. Yeah, anything else you want to talk about? I mean, Prop Joe's pretty snakish in this this episode and storyline for sure. What else you want to talk about, man? We got to go through Bubbles and his tragic.
Yeah.
So he's really suffering at the hands of this really psychopathic dope fiend and
a bully.
Yeah.
Really.
kind of begging Kima for work, even though she's moved on, and his best option now, unfortunately, is to deal with Herc and Dozierman, who are pretty useless at you know, serving anyone else's interests.
Yeah. Completely dangerous. You know, they, you know, get Bubs in on this scheme to do like the whole hat trick so they could find out who little Kevin really is. They get him into the interrogation room, and even Sidner is like, this interview is bullshit. They don't have a lead on anything. And they fucking get Randy's name dropped into the mix a little bit, like, you know, putting the nail in his coffin, or, you know, eradicating any chance that he has for a happy, normal life because their incompetence as law enforcement led them back that way. But yeah, man, I know I've harped on it a lot throughout this project, how, like, badly Bubbles is mistreated by the system at large, and how Kima and McNulty just use the resources only within the confines of law enforcement to help Bubbles out or like get him work. It's like what is Kima thinking, like, when she like passes him off onto this like an nincompoop who's just gonna like worsen his life? Because like, if anybody who sees like Bubbles in this situation, wouldn't you want to be like, let's get you into a fucking treatment program or something? Like, let's find you housing. Yeah. Like, what is the line of thinking here? Like, are they so blinded by their, like, you know, mission in law enforcement that they're just making horrible, rash decisions with this guy's life hanging in the balance?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, is this just, I mean, is this part of the bigger message? Because I don't know, you know, with David Simon, who, you know, he's like works with the cops and all that stuff. I mean, like, would he intentionally cast the police in this light? Like, is that his mission here? Or is this just like a lapse in, you know?
I don't know. I don't know, like, because like, I feel like when I first watched this show, I wasn't picking up on like these things of like,
yeah,
how the cops are kind of exploiting this poor guy, like, all throughout the show. Like, I don't know if this is like, you know, this show is so great and has like kind of like morphed into the conversation at any given like point or time in history that like finally now people are starting to realize.
You're like, oh my God, this is just like part of the larger metaphor, the death of work. People matter less and less every day, and Bubbles is just another victim of like our, you know, predatory, whatever, capitalist society.
No, screw that. He should pull himself up by his bootstraps and go get a real... No.
The gods will not save you.
Yeah. We don't think that way.
Hey, you never, if it could... for some likes, new followers. All right, man. Yeah. What else do you want to talk about? You want to talk about Daniels and Pearlman? If you don't want to touch on that, it's a little isolated. But
yeah, yeah. I mean, Daniels and Pearlman. Yeah, I mean, like, what is there to say? They're perhaps like a little naive in thinking that like Carchetti is going to be the one to like turn the trajectory of the city of Baltimore around, and you know, it'll be on a more like positive path from here on out, because. As we see.
Yeah, I knew we had to get one, man.
With Carchetti being involved in his first budget meeting.
Yeah.
Is that what you call it?
You tell me.
He's already kind of getting corrupted by the influence of politics. You know, he has to promote Stan Valchek to a higher position because he feels like indebted to him in a way. He still doesn't know like the whole thing about like Daniels's shady money dealings past with Marla, like when, you know, his past life is law enforcement.
Eastern. Yeah. Well, so this kind of settles our discussion from many episodes ago where we're questioning Norm as the advisor, having worked for the Sun for all those years, yet not knowing. So that must have been really an airtight
incident.
Within the police department. I mean, but with the amount of, you know, backstabbing and snitching that goes on, I'm surprised it never leaked to the press. But regardless, hey, they don't even know. And Rawls doesn't think on Daniels in that moment.
Yeah. I mean, you could tell he kind of wants to, though. Or, like, he feels conflicted about it because he knows, like, he's seeing down the line if it's going to jeopardize his career in any way if Daniels's past activity comes to light. So what is going on like a lot in this like budget meeting? It's kind of confusing. They're talking about like waterfront properties, townhomes.
I have no idea. I mean, it's really just like Norris kind of pushing back on this whole, oh, yeah, I mean, we just got to give a $50,000 pay raise to the next police commissioner. Right. So that way we can attract, you know, someone like a minority, a black commander to Baltimore because, you know, maybe Baltimore is a little D2 in this respect. They're a small market team, whereas, you know, New York City and Los Angeles, they are going to attract the premier, you know, free agents, if you will, in law enforcement. So you got to, like, clear some salary cap space or, you know, do a little sign-in trade with Burrell.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, yeah, Narissa just, she's got screwed. I mean, she's the city council president, right? And Royce, what was up with that with Royce? I mean,
yeah, it's like he was grooming her to be his successor, basically. And she's basically like accusing Tommy and Tony of jumping the line because she was supposed to be next in line. And it's like one of those examples of like how good the writing on this show is, because it's like everybody is like cynical and wrong in this situation. Yeah. Like she is like was hoping to cash in on like a political dynasty and basically like cruise into an election, but you know, people do bring up like really good points that Tommy's strategy of splitting the black vote was like really cynical, and you know, not, it didn't have like people's best interests in mind. And here he is like talking about like, well, you'll be mayor like in no time at all, because I've got my eyes like on the governorship. It's just like so many people, so many power hungry people just like arguing with each other over the nuances of like what was right and like what was your turn to take and this and yeah. this and blah, blah, blah. And politics is a nasty game. Okay. Everybody should just know their place. No.
I mean, so you're saying Maurice should just accept?
No, I don't know how to I don't know like what to feel, because I feel like they're both kind of have shitty yeah. belief systems.
Yeah. But yeah.
And it's like unfortunate that like they could so cynically like bring race into this question, like in terms of Burrell, like where he does like the little power move of like, if you want to get rid of me, you're gonna have to like fire me, and it's gonna make you look bad, like firing a black police commissioner, even though he was incompetent or like did morally questionable things in a lot of ways, and he makes him pay for the check again at Werner's, like and he did in the previous season.
Boss move to go shoot 9. He's like, I'm not even gonna go the full 18. I mean, you know, yeah. I'm old, but good stuff.
So we, I mean,
but yeah, I mean, I do this. Sorry, you asked me a specific question. I'm like, well, you know, trades. Let's do some basketball parallels. But no, I mean, the whole, yeah, it's just like the whole brick and mortar kind of got to have your name on something. The whole right. Westport Patapsco kind of like. I guess I could draw the
tourism draw.
Yeah, like it's like D2 to the Inner Harbor. You know, this would be yeah. for the Washington commuter crowd. So I'm assuming that means people who work in Baltimore, or people who commute south to DC for government jobs, but could find like a nice place to live over in Westport, which is where a lot of things kind of take place. Like
in season two.
Rumored of Marlo having a funeral parlor to dispose of bodies down there. And the stripper Kima questions, who is Chardine's colleague, is from there. And
right.
Good stuff.
And yeah, it's negatively affecting a lot of the characters from season two, probably, this discussion that they're having. It's
a long time ago. What? I mean, what is Nick so upset about? I mean, aside from just having like a punchable demeanor, you know, it's like, can it be gentrification if Aunt Teensy's place over on Covington's getting, like, you know, sold to the wealthier white folk? But I guess it can't be. I mean,
it's you know, that ties into the whole, like, conversation that surrounded, like, the BET's crazy decision back in the day when they were airing The Wire and they cut out a lot of the scenes from season two that featured white people.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of, like, went against, like, the whole premise of the show that, like, you know, capitalism affects everybody in negative ways, and we're gonna need a rainbow coalition of people to kind of like coalesce and fight back against industrialization if, you know, we're all gonna have a chance at like working together to make society a better place for ourselves. But yeah, I know I'm like pretty harsh on Carchetti a lot of the time, when other people seem to think like he's a good guy. But I feel like this episode is a really good turning point to show that Carchetti's true political ambitions are coming more into focus, and it may be like more cynical and not as progressive as we once thought. And definitely like Herc's whole thing is coming into focus, where he's just like pretty much a out and out villain at this point, ruining little kids' lives.
Yep. I mean, well said, man.
So know your place out there, everybody, and donate to to our podcast.
Don't be like Herc and help make kids win.
Ooh, yes.
So please donate so we can support, you know, a great cause and the memory of phenomenal actor and amazing person Michael K. Williams.
Anything else you
not really after saying that. I mean, it's like, yeah, let me talk about this one street and blah 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 Bendaloo. So anyways, Yeah. How do we do this again? Thanks to our listeners, everyone who's supported us through and through. And hey, we're up on all the socials, you know, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, God Save.
Yeah.
The gods will not save you.
That's right.
Pretty much, right? Yeah.
Anybody who wants to reach out to us on a more personal level, ask us questions, comments, or concerns, you could always reach us on email at thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com.
Yeah. And always a pleasure to, you know, give a shout out to Mostard for providing us with some of his original music, intros, outro, and bumper music. So check out his extensive catalog at mostart.com.
And also thank you to Andre Tesnes, who did our incredible podcast logo with his graphic design skills.
Yeah.
All right, thanks everybody.
Thank you.